In this show, we are looking back at the ongoing genocide in Gaza. Every day, around 100 people are being killed in Gaza, most of them related to trying to get food from the food distribution system that is very cynically setting up situations where many people are being slaughtered every day. First, we have a report on the Gaza Tribunal that was held in Bosnia-Herzegovina. This is coming from the Electronic Intifada. And then second, we'll hear an interview with Francesca Albanese, who is the UN's special rapporteur on the Palestinian situation. And she's going to describe the economic incentives that are causing this genocide. So here we have a show from the Electronic Intifada.
You're watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Ali Abu Nerma, here with my colleague, Nora Barrows-Friedman. Last week, Sarajevo, the capital of Bosnia and Herzegovina, hosted the opening public session of the Gaza Tribunal. It's a people's tribunal formed by a coalition of international legal scholars, human rights experts, and others to investigate Israel's genocide and war crimes in Gaza. Holding the opening session in Bosnia, itself the site of genocide in the early 1990s, has powerful resonance. Let's take a look at this video of Penny Green, Professor of Law at Queen Mary University of London, launching the Sarajevo Declaration of the Gaza Tribunal on May 29th.
In the Declaration of Sarajevo, the Gaza Tribunal declares our collective moral outrage at the continuing genocide in Palestine, and our solidarity with the people of Palestine, our commitment to working with partners across global civil society to end the genocide, and to ensure accountability for perpetrators and enablers, redress for victims and survivors, the building of a more just international order, and a free Palestine. In the declaration, we call out and condemn the myriad crimes of the Israeli regime. We demand an immediate end to those crimes, including the occupation, the siege, the apartheid, and the genocide, and freedom for Palestinian prisoners. We defend UNRWA and other humanitarian actors on the ground and demand accountability for the attacks on them. We call on all governments and on regional and international organizations to act, and we denounce those who have been complicit, from states to media corporations and others. In the declaration, we denounce the wave of persecution and crackdowns on human rights defenders, peace activists, students, academics, workers, professionals. And we honor those who stand up, who despite this persecution have had the courage and moral convictions to stand up and speak out.
Penny Green is a member of the steering committee of the Gaza Tribunal, along with our next guest, Craig Mukhaibar. Craig, as our regular viewers will know, is a human rights lawyer with more than three decades of experience. He served as the director of the New York office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights until he resigned in October 2023 over the world body's inaction in the face of Israel's genocide. We're delighted to have him join us again now to talk about the Gaza Tribunal and what role it can play in the effort to hold Israel accountable for its genocide in Gaza. Welcome back to the Electronic Intifada live stream, Craig.
Thank you. Hi, Ali and Nora. Nice to be back.
It's really good to have you back on.
Thanks so much, Craig. Before we focus specifically on the Gaza Tribunal, I want to briefly get your assessment of where things stand more generally in terms of international legal and political efforts to stop the horror Israel is openly perpetrating in Gaza. We've seen a sharp uptick in criticism of Israel's actions, even by some of its staunchest allies. In mid-May, for example, France, the UK, and Canada threatened Israel with unspecified concrete actions if it doesn't end its starvation siege of Gaza. And just last week, Ireland became the first Western country and member of the EU, to declare at the highest level of its government that Israel is perpetrating genocide. The EU is also reportedly reviewing its association agreement with Israel. And yet, none of these states has gone much beyond words of condemnation at this point. Do you think this is about to change, or is it just more of the same, an effort to placate public outrage that is not going away?
I think in some sense, Ali, it's all of the above. I mean, there's no doubt that all we've seen so far are threats and rhetorical measures to do something somewhere down the road if something doesn't change. And we are 600 days into a live stream genocide. That is just not good enough. Some of the states that have been a little bit tougher in their rhetoric in the last couple of weeks are states that have been directly complicit in the genocide. They have a lot of accountability lined up for them beyond these kinds of acknowledgments. There is an effort among a lot of member states in preparation for the upcoming June conference on Palestine coming up in the United Nations to try to contain the fallout from Israel's crimes in such a way that preserves the two-state solution, shifts attention to humanitarian aid only, a promise of a two-state solution, recognition of the state of Palestine, these sorts of things. And then in the meantime, some European states and others saying, well, you know, if you don't stop, we may in some way complicate trade relations and so on. No hard measures have been implemented yet. That said, these statements would not be happening if it weren't for the global uprising against the genocide in Palestine and Western complicity in the genocide in Palestine. They've begun to feel the heat, more than a year and a half into this genocide. And that's a good sign. It means that we need to keep up the pressure. It means that there are, however slight, cracks in the institutional resistance to accountability for Israel and protection for the Palestinian people. So it is a very good signal, but it is tiny, it's far too little too late, and we need to keep pushing to turn it into something more meaningful. In fact, you know, people talk about a failure of international law. I don't think we've seen a failure of international law because the law has repeatedly come down on the side of Palestine. In this situation, it has repeatedly come down in favor of accountability for Israeli perpetrators, redress for Palestinian victims, Palestinian freedom overall. What has failed is enforcement. What has failed is action by international institutions and states to actually give teeth to the pronouncements that are made with regard to Israeli violations, genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, gross violations of human rights. Some of that is by design in the international system. Some of that is because of abdication by prominent actors within the international system. The Secretary General of the United Nations, who continues to seek refuge behind language of two sides and conflict resolution and humanitarian aid and a two-state solution, never calling out the genocide, never demanding accountability for Israeli perpetrators, never daring to address root causes like Zionism and settler colonialism and ethnic supremacism and so on. And the same, you know, with High Commissioner for Human Rights, the same with the so-called Special Advisor on the Prevention of Genocide, the same with senior political leaders across the international system, not to mention the direct complicity of the European Union as we're looking at these. And obviously the complete abdication of Arab governments around the region from their responsibility to step up and defend the Palestinians from genocide. So, I think, like all global movements in the past, the pressure has to be for enforcement. Right now, all of the enforcement action is in the hands of people through boycott, divestment, sanction, all of those sorts of things, legal initiatives being undertaken for prosecutions and civil accountability for perpetrators, you know, disruption, civil disobedience, protest. All of those sorts of things are in our hands to press for enforcement, as was the case in the civil rights movement in the United States, in the anti-Vietnam aggression movement in the West, in the anti-apartheid movement for South Africa in the West. These were all cases in history that demonstrated to us how essential it is for people to exercise moral leadership when governments and institutions refuse to do so or are directly complicit. So it's a failure of enforcement, not so much a failure of law. And that we need to be focused on that. And while we take our wins in some rhetoric that is changing amongst Europeans and others, we have to press for much, much more, I think.
And just if I may, just as a follow up, do you have any sense of any movement in the case at the International Court of Justice, South Africa's genocide case? And also, there was some news in recent days relating to the International Criminal Court. The chief prosecutor, Karim Khan, has gone on leave because of some allegations about potential workplace harassment that he's accused of. And there was a report in the Wall Street Journal that said that he was about to issue indictments for Bezalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir, these two ultra-far-right Israeli ministers. But he couldn't get them out before he had to go on leave. And according to the Wall Street Journal, it is unlikely that his deputies will do so in his absence. What do you make of all this?
Well, there's a multi-layered campaign of obstruction of justice being carried out at all levels, in the dark rooms of The Hague, from Israeli spy agencies and U.S. spy agencies offering threats and inducements to judges and people in the prosecution and so on. There is a direct full frontal assault by the government of the United States against the court, imposing sanctions on the prosecutor's office, threatening sanctions against judges, threatening not just the court and the prosecution, but anyone who does business with them, whether they're non-governmental organizations or lawyers or internet providers. The ICC's case against these Israeli genocidaires has essentially ground to a halt, that they are unable to function in any meaningful way because, you know, Microsoft shut down their email, for example. All essential non-governmental actors who are involved in the justice process, many of them have had to pull out for fear of arrest or punishment. Bank accounts have been frozen to prevent them from, you know, doing anything, paying staff or financing investigation and so on. And then on top of all of this, you have a smear campaign conducted by Israel proxy groups in the West to discredit the court and individual actors there. And while all of these things are going on, we suddenly are notified that the chief prosecutor who brought the indictments in the first place is stepping aside under a cloud of accusations of harassment. I don't think it's a coincidence by any means. You know, he was the one who belatedly, but I think assertively, brought the cases and was carrying on and was about to release more indictments for more senior Israeli perpetrators. And suddenly he gets shoved aside in these circumstances. So, you know, I think the last time we spoke, I said, and I'll say it again, the pressure on the ICC, the ICJ, the UN, other official institutions to do the wrong thing is enormous and unprecedented. And they are using everything they can use. Threats and bribery and sanctions and smears and all these sort of things to prevent these judicial officers from doing the right thing. The most important thing that can happen with these mechanisms now is to make sure that the pressure they're getting from the public to do the right thing, to not allow justice to be obstructed, to not delay the case, to not hold back on indictments and prosecutions, that pressure has to be greater than the pressure that's coming from these rogue actors in the U.S. government and in the Israeli government and their intelligence agency. So I always encourage people, keep this on the agenda, keep the pressure on. The International Court of Justice has been proceeding apace. That pace is a slow pace, always. So by the time they complete the genocide case in the International Court of Justice, we're likely to be a couple of years away, and that's too late to save anybody. I do believe that unless there are significant obstruction threats and so on there that actually succeed, that there is just on the law and the facts alone, it is guaranteed effectively that the International Court of Justice will come down with a finding of genocide and with findings for accountability of perpetrators of the Israeli state, and that all of these things feed each other, right? I mean, Israel is on trial for genocide in the world court. I'll say it again. Its leaders are the subject to arrest warrants for crimes against humanity in the International Criminal Court. There are individual legal proceedings underway in third states all around the world brought by activists and legal mechanisms and so on. There is a mountain of evidence that's been collected by independent UN human rights mechanisms and major non-governmental organizations. The accountability, the visibility of accountability is so much greater than it was just a few years ago. But enforcement is going to depend on insistence from all of us. So those processes continue. They are running into serious difficulties, as we knew that they would. But I think it's up to all of us to keep them on the rail.
Craig, I had a question before we talk about the Gaza Tribunal. I wanted to kind of just get your analysis and reaction to, you know, 90 days of forced starvation, total siege, and now we have this, you know, U.S., this private mercenary corporation, the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. People in Gaza are calling it the Gaza Humiliation Foundation, where nearly every day this week that it's been opened, Israeli and possibly U.S. forces have opened fire on starving Palestinians trying to access, you know, really what's, you know, the kind of one box of snacks that you could get at a corner store. Nothing to address the just enormous, incalculable need of people after 90 days of starvation. The United Nations and its partners have been saying, you know, since March 2nd, when the crossings closed by, you know, when Israel closed the crossings, that, you know, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of trucks waiting to enter and that they must be let in. But, you know, those, again, those are statements. Those are, you know, those are words. And people have been saying that, you know, Palestinians can't eat words. They can't eat, you know, statements like this. What are the physical material machinations that could be taken by the UN and its partners with their trucks at the crossings? What would it take to actually force Israel to open these crossings and not just have this, you know, private mercenary corporation being able to call the shots, you know, literally and figuratively right now?
Well, you know, this Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, so-called, is the most cynical ruse that anybody has ever seen. Perfidious. Absolutely. You know, these are not, this is a hodgepodge of Israeli and U.S. intelligence operatives, sketchy finance firms in the U.S., mercenaries and private military contractors posing as humanitarians, but actually set up as a part of the Israeli regime's strategy for occupation and the final phase of the genocide in Gaza. You know, the most frustrating thing was to hear media reports referring to this as an aid scheme, or as a humanitarian alternative and so on. It was not conceived as such, it was not set up as such, it has not functioned as such. And at least that ruse is beginning to fall apart, that there is widespread recognition now that this is anything but a humanitarian scheme, and that it's not being done to relieve the suffering in Gaza or to feed the Palestinian people. It was set up as first a fig leaf to tamp down on Western public pressure on the Israeli regime, kind of a smokescreen for its genocide, because some people were complaining about the starvation. It was set up as a vehicle to get the UN, especially UNRWA, out of the way of the regime's genocide, because the UN is the main lifeline of the people in Gaza in these circumstances. So they need to shove them aside with this fake mechanism. And it is set up specifically as a tool to drive genocide supporters southward into a handful of, let's call them, concentration camps, clearing the north of Gaza, concentrating survivors, in essence, for easy departure or death. And in place of perfectly efficient and effective UN aid distribution networks that had, you know, long-standing relationships with the communities, perfectly able to deliver food from pickup points to the people who need it, thousands of trucks waiting outside the checkpoints. In place of this functioning thing, they created a lie that has been denied by everybody, including U.S. Personnel in the know, that somehow Hamas was interfering with the aid and therefore we couldn't rely on these mechanisms. That was a lie. They created this fake humanitarian organization. They blocked all humanitarian aid from the UN and other humanitarian organizations. They shut down UN operations, those that they hadn't already destroyed. And they set up these four distribution points, three of them near the Egyptian border in Rafah, one near the Netzarim occupation corridor just south of Gaza City. Then they told starving Palestinians to walk for hours, to risk their life on the way, to stand in cages under the hot Gaza sun for hours. Some of them are abducted by Israeli occupation forces before they even get to the cages. And you know, for many Palestinians, if they're abducted, that means repeated beatings and torture and sexual assault and disappearance or death. Many who manage to get to the lines are turned away from those lines. Many, of course, are too weak, too sick, too disabled, too old, too pregnant, too busy caring for children to even attempt to get to those distribution points. And we've seen some who dare to risk it can be shot down by Israeli quadcopters and tanks and snipers. More than 100 people have already been killed at these GHF aid traps, and hundreds more have been wounded, and many that we don't know how many have been abducted by the Israel occupation forces. And then even, Nora, if you succeed, what you get is a meager package of food, well below nutritional requirements, and mostly dry goods with no clean water or fuel with which to prepare it. And in the meantime, Israel systematically destroying homes and tents and refugee shelters to prevent you from returning home so you have no place to go. That is not an aid plan. That is a cruel component of the genocide in Palestine. It is wholly, and it's not just Israel, it's the United States. This is a joint genocidal effort by those two governments. And so looking for the U.S. To play any role that would relate to enforcement is impossible. Right now, as we speak, there is a Security Council ceasefire attempt, the fifth, since this wave of genocide began, and the U.S. is poised to veto it. As far as when we started here, it hadn't happened yet, but the U.S. is poised to veto this E10 resolution that would call for an immediate and permanent ceasefire. So it's not going to come from that direction. And that's why these official institutions like the Security Council, which is completely blocked by the U.S. from taking any meaningful action, not just for a ceasefire, but let's say a protection force, a military intervention, an accountability mechanism, all of those, even removing Israel, you know, the murderer of UN staff still has UN credentials and voting rights. So having them still present, the Security Council nor the GA has done the job that they need to do. And then in the meantime, we see this week that the General Assembly of the United Nations elected Annalena Baerbock of Germany, who rose to prominence in her vociferous defense of the genocide against the Palestinian people, and including the targeting of children and families and so on. And she has just been elected as the next president of the General Assembly, put forward by Germany, endorsed by the entire Western Europe and other group, and not obstructed by the majority of governments around the world that just accept these rotations of posts through the various regional groups. And that means that this person complicit in genocide, and enthusiastically so, will be presiding over the General Assembly during the genocide, during efforts to follow up on the previous resolution of the General Assembly to hold Israel accountable, during the UN conference on Palestine coming up in June. It is an absolute scandal that this has happened. So I will just repeat it again. Moral leadership will not come from these institutions, official institutions. It will come from us, come from people and movements, or not at all.
Well, let's thanks for that, Craig. And let's get into the nuts and bolts of what the Gaza Tribunal is. Is it an official body, and why is it needed? What's it going to do? What is the efficacy of this body, and how are Palestinians involved?
Well, in fact, a lot of prominent Palestinians are actually members of the tribunal. It is a tribunal that recognizes Palestinian leadership, Palestinian agency, Palestinian self-determination, and it is a tribunal that is working in solidarity with the Palestinian people, both those who are members of the tribunal and those in Palestinian civil society with which the tribunal collaborates. I mean, your viewers will be familiar with the original Russell Tribunal 60 years ago, as the world was watching U.S. brutality being perpetrated on the people of Vietnam, aggression, serial atrocities, and that it was doing so with absolute impunity. That's when Bertrand Russell, this prominent British philosopher, public intellectual, first launched the People's Tribunal as an organized expression of moral outrage. And he explained what these mechanisms are about. He said, "We are not judges, we are witnesses. And our task is to make humankind witness to the terrible crimes that we're seeing, and to unite humanity on the side of justice." So it's not a formal legal institution in that sense, although we've got many prominent international lawyers in the tribunal, but it is much more of this global civil society action to respond to the horrors and to the impunity and to the complicity that we're seeing connected to the horrors being perpetrated in Palestine. And we just finished a week of meetings, as you said, in Sarajevo, where the Declaration of Sarajevo was adopted, setting out the principles that you heard Penny Green enumerating there in that clip. But the tribunal is also working on the building of a so-called jury of conscience to make a final pronouncement in the coming months on all of the issues before it. It is compiling an archive of evidence that will be available not just for the jury of conscience, but for other actors outside of the of the tribunal. It has been hearing victim testimony, witness testimony, expert testimony, doing its own analysis, linking with the broader movement for Palestine in order to advance the cause of justice that has been wholly abandoned by official institutions. So it is a kind of a tribunal, but it is a tribunal which is not constrained by the constraints that are imposed on official institutions. And that allows it to behave differently, as you will see from the language in the Declaration of Sarajevo. There's none of this political correctness or gag orders that are imposed on other kinds of institutions. It begins with this basic idea that Palestinians are human beings with human rights, and that we need to speak out loud about those things that are obstructing their rights. And you will see when you read the declaration that the language is clear and principled. The tribunal rejects the both sides approach, which doesn't apply in Palestine, because in Palestine, the two sides are colonizer and colonized, occupier and occupied, oppressor and oppressed, genocidaire and victims. It rejects that approach, which is often adopted by international institutions, too afraid to describe the real issues at hand. It does not recognize the Israel exception to international law that seems to creep into national policy and sometimes into international mechanisms, but it demands that Israel be held accountable. It does not accept the gag orders that you will see other institutions use. The tribunal speaks very openly about root causes, for example, and uses the words that official institutions and states refuse to utter, like Zionism, like settler colonialism, like ethno-supremacism, like apartheid, because they are the root of the problem.
And well, Craig, go ahead. Yeah. Just on that, why don't we take a look? We actually have a clip, another clip of Penny Green reading part of the declaration, and I'd like you to comment on that. So why don't we take a look at that now?
We also reject the destructive ideology of Zionism as the official state ideology of the Israeli regime, of the forces that colonized Palestine and established the Israeli state on its ruins, and of pro-Israel organizations and their proxies today. Instead, the declaration insists, in the words of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, that all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights, and that there are no exceptions to this rule. The Tribunal calls in the Declaration for decolonization across the land and an end to the ethno-supremacist order and the replacement of Zionism with a dispensation founded on equal human rights for Christians, Muslims, Jews, and others.
And I'll also add, Craig, that the declaration also states, and I'm quoting from it now, we recognize the right of the Palestinian people to resist foreign occupation, colonial domination, apartheid, subjugation by a racist regime, and aggression, including through the use of armed struggle, in accordance with and is recognized in international law and is affirmed by the United Nations General Assembly. As you said, there are no gags on what this tribunal will say or address. Talk about, it is pretty atypical for international legal gatherings to take on these issues head on, particularly Zionism and the right to armed struggle. Talk about why the tribunal is doing this and whether you think the world is ready to hear this kind of clear language.
Well, the why is, first of all, because it's the right thing to do. It's the moral thing to do, that if you believe in universal human rights, then human rights are universal, which is to say that they apply to everyone without exception, and that includes the Palestinian people. And for too long, especially during the 30 years of the Oslo process, international law, international human rights, the rules of the game were pushed aside in favor of this disingenuous political process that said to the Palestinians, you must negotiate for your rights with your oppressor. The tribunal rejects this. It does not accept any of these gag orders. It looks at what international law says. It looks at what basic moral precepts say, and it applies them to the situation. And so when it talks about bigotry and discrimination, it says that the struggle must be against all forms of racism, bigotry, and discrimination, including the equal rejection of Islamophobia, anti-Arab and anti-Palestinian racism, anti-Semitism, as well as an acknowledgement of the horrific effects that Zionism, apartheid, and settler colonialism has had on the Palestinian people. This is just axiomatic. This is a fundamental truth. It is undeniable that Zionism has had a disastrous effect on the human rights of the Palestinian people for 100 years. And so, having done the analysis, the declaration explicitly rejects the ideology of Zionism as destructive ideology. And what it calls for is a remedy to that deeply racist, fundamentally violent approach to Israel and Palestine. It calls for decolonization across all of historic Palestine. It calls for an end to the ethno-supremacist order. It calls for explicitly for replacing Zionism with a dispensation founded on equal human rights for Christians, Muslims, Jews, and others. And it does so because it's right, but it also does so because, in every other situation addressed by international institutions where there is a conflict or a crisis, it is just accepted wisdom that the way you resolve it is to address the root causes. Only in Palestine are we told that we have to ignore the root causes and just make a deal. And unless you address those root causes, you cannot have a sustainable resolution of the conflict. Before you even get to the fundamental imperative of justice, that perpetrators of genocide, perpetrators of apartheid, perpetrators of systematic crimes against humanity are not counterparts in any solution. They are actors who need to be held accountable under the rule of law before you can move on to some sort of a sustainable resolution. These are just realities that apply across the board, but have not been applied in the situation of Palestine. And the tribunal is absolutely committed to following common sense, international law, and basic morality in the way it addresses the problem. That's why,
And one of the planned outputs of the Gaza Tribunal is an archive of evidence. What are the types of evidence that it will include, and how is it being gathered?
So one of the strengths of the tribunal is that it is very well networked with people in the movement more broadly. Another strength is that there are a lot of international lawyers on board who are plugged into the legal community internationally more broadly, that we have access to witnesses and victims, experts and so on, all of whom are providing testimony. All of that evidence is being compiled into this archive of evidence that, as I said, will both be for the benefit of the jury of conscience that will be convened to pronounce in the way that the Russell Tribunal has pronounced and so on, but also to be made available to other actors who are pursuing accountability and justice, whether those are official institutions or institutions in movements and in civil society. We've got some good experts working on the compiling of that archive of evidence.
And I know, some people may ask, is there a way that the general public can also submit evidence? Is it an insular process? What is the process, if you can tell us any details about that?
Well, it's a public process. We're not meeting in secret chambers in the way that some institutions do. And so the archive will be public. The hearings have been public. They're all posted on YouTube in succession. At Gaza Tribunal / YouTube or YouTube / Gaza Tribunal, however that works. There is a website, a public website, in which these things are also provided publicly. There's broad participation in the meetings, and the entire process going forward will also be a public process. And the names of everyone who is associated with the tribunal are listed on the website. Members of the three chambers, of the advisory committee, of the steering committee, philosophers and lawyers and activists and sociologists and historians and prominent public intellectuals and leaders in Palestinian civil society, all listed there and accessible on behalf of the tribunal.
That's fantastic. Ali, did you want to add?
It feels like, Craig, that, I think perhaps when we spoke to you a few months ago, there was a fear I think many of us had, I think I had, that the genocide in Gaza was fading into the background, and there was a risk that it was just going to carry on and the world would move on from it. It seems like more recently that's not the case. We see the Gaza Freedom Flotilla moving towards Gaza now with very prominent people on board, with Greta Thunberg is on board, and there are legislators and members of parliament from all over Europe. The actor Liam Cunningham is participating, and many, many other people, just ordinary people who have set aside their daily lives to take part in this. And there's an effort to organize a march from Cairo to Gaza, which the effort itself is heroic. I know that I took part in the Gaza Freedom March in 2009, and I can tell you from firsthand experience how efficient Egyptian security is at shutting things down. But the point is that people are trying to break the siege. I don't want to speak for that effort. I'm talking about what I went through in 2009. We're seeing protests all over the world. I was in Ireland myself 2 weeks ago, and it was just inspiring to see the protests. So there is all this energy, and yet the atrocities aren't stopping. They're not even slowing down. It just seems to be getting worse, more horrific, more brazen. So, and yet there is people around the world. We just published a piece at the Electronic Intifada about a new Pew survey that shows that Israel is viewed negatively on all over the world, on every continent, and that, these numbers are just getting worse and worse from Israel's perspective. I guess my question, it is this sort of mixed picture. Things are worse than ever, and at the same time there is this global uprising of support. And so I guess my question is what words do you have for people watching? How can people stay encouraged, mobilized, inspired to keep the message going and to keep it front and center? What would you say to people who are watching?
The only way that we can save our mental health when we have a front row seat to a genocide is to be active. The only thing that we can do is to be active. Solidarity has always been the biggest weapon that we have. You know, all those initiatives that you mentioned, Ali, every one of them is a people's initiative. They're not being convened by governments or international institutions or groups of states or international tribunals. It is a people's march to Gaza. It is a people's freedom flotilla sailing to Gaza. It is a people's tribunal that is conducting these hearings. It is people's demonstrations that are happening on college campuses and graduation ceremonies and in the capitals of cities all around the world. And where this moral gap has been left by our governments and our institutions. Our governments are corrupted and captured. Our international institutions are cowed. The courts are on the defensive. And so it has left this tremendous moral gulf that's being filled by people in the same way that those other movements we spoke about earlier in this conversation were filled by people. Let's face it, our governments are perpetrators. And they are not coming to the rescue. And that goes for those that are directly perpetrating the genocide, like the government of the United States, and those that are complicit, like many European governments, and those that are sitting on their hands and doing nothing, like many Arab governments, although some of those are collaborating as well. So that gulf has to be filled by people. And if you see all of the creative initiatives that people are taking, the encampments were creative. The flotilla, all of these things that we're talking about, creative initiatives on filling that moral gulf, not just to make a statement to each other, but because we know from history, this is the way that you chip away at the complicity of your own institutions and states. This is the way you chip away at the impunity of the Israeli regime and other perpetrators. And while we cannot win this battle overnight, because we don't have the armies and the drones and the bombs and the money that the bad guys have in this situation, we will keep chipping away. And the more people join in and take action, if you do not belong to an organization or an organized effort, join one or start one. There are plenty out there. Get involved in these things. Help to publicize it. Make it morally unsustainable for our governments and our institutions and our universities and our corporations and our international organizations and our regional organizations to continue on the downward spiral in which we see them, in which we see them now. And there's no reason to be discouraged, because we are seeing light. We're living in the darkness. There's no question about it. But there are these little glimmers of light, and those glimmers of light didn't come from above. They came from people. And so keep chipping away, keep cracking into the wall of impunity, and keep fighting for a more moral vision. And the Sarajevo Declaration is one articulation of what that moral vision should look like. But others can formulate others. But the most important thing is join, get organized, take action, isolate the Israeli regime, boycott, divestment, sanction. Identify perpetrators, look for prosecutions, support those institutions that are standing up, though they are few and far between, and speak out publicly. And this is the last thing, especially at this moment in history, where the Israeli regime, its proxies in the West, and complicit government actors in Western governments have launched the most oppressive regime of the silencing of human rights defenders that we have ever seen in the West. On behalf of this one small oppressive foreign regime called Israel, silencing their own people in the United States, in Canada, in Europe, and elsewhere, that's the time for us to speak up more loudly and more often. Their hope is that this campaign of fear will quiet us down, and then it's done. So the more downward push we feel to be silent, the more we have to push up, speak out, disrupt, protest, demonstrate, isolate the regime and just declare that we will not be silent and that we dissent to apartheid, we dissent to settler colonialism, we dissent to genocide, and we dissent to the complicity of our own governments and institutions.
That's so beautifully said, Craig. I'll add one more thing or amplify one thing you said, which is speak out and be visible. I have to say it provides me personally with so much comfort when I see people showing visible signs of support for Palestine, whether it's a flag in their window, whether it's a bumper sticker, whether it's something tied, you know, a button or a badge tied to their backpack, whatever it is, it lifts my heart. And I know that it does for other Palestinians who have friends, who have family, who themselves are suffering, who themselves feel isolated in the communities they live. And it normalizes it. It gives other people the courage to speak out. So even those little things, nothing is too little. We should all do as much as we can, but nothing is too little. So thank you for that reminder, Craig. Thank you for always giving us a sense of direction and hope and deep knowledge and understanding. We will be following the activities of the Gaza Tribunal, and we hope you'll come back and talk to us about what happens next soon.
Anytime, and with pleasure. And the other thing, Ali, wear a keffiyeh, everybody. I bought a case of them. I handed them out to everyone I know. It is a very clear and visible symbol of humanity and of solidarity with the Palestinian people and of dissent to the genocide and the apartheid. And I've never seen so many keffiyehs outside of Palestine in my whole life as I'm seeing these days. So I want to endorse what Ali said. You know, outward symbols of solidarity are very important. And just normalize it and make it everywhere.
Make it everywhere. Thank you so much, Craig. It's always a pleasure and an honor to have you.
Always an honor to be with you. Thanks for your excellent work, as always.
And that was taken from a website called the Electronic Intifada. You can find it on the web. Coming up, we have an interview with Chris Hedges and Francesca Albanese, two very well-informed. Perhaps Francesca Albanese is the most informed person on our planet regarding what has been going on in the genocide.
How much has this changed the global community? And I'm thinking in particular, of course, within the global South, which suffered their own Holocaust. You mentioned the Herero and the Namaqua, but the Armenians, the Kenyans under British colonialism, the Indians, especially the 1943 Bengal famine, for instance, 3 million Indians died. And these Holocausts are not recognized by their perpetrators. Caesarea in Discourse on Colonialism says that the reason that the Holocaust carried out by the Nazis against the Jews resonated was because the tactics that were employed, and these are his words, against the coolies in India and the blacks in Africa and the Algerians by the French in Algeria just were turned on other white Europeans. But of course, it's been the Global South, led by South Africa, that has stood up to try and impose the rule of law on Israel on the genocide. But is this reconfiguring the global community?
I think it is. I think it is. Not as fast as ending the genocide would require, but it is. So there are different trends that I see. First of all, as you say, there is a coming together around certain basic things. I've never heard so many people speaking the language of international law. Seriously. I mean, it's as a lawyer, as a human rights lawyer, if I were given the opportunity to not to look at the genocide for a moment, I would feel that the human rights mission is somewhat fulfilled, because people are aware, and are aware through a common lens that is allowing many, really, from Africa to Asia, to the global minority and other places, really, to look at Palestine and recognize that there is some commonalities. People speak the language of human rights. Phenomenal, right? There is also another aspect of awakening. Is that never before have I heard so many people connecting the dots between the past and the present, and the colonial past and the present. I don't know if you agree with me, but at least I sense that there is a global awareness of something that has for a long time been a prerogative, a painful prerogative of the global majority, the global South, meaning the awareness of the pain and the wounds of colonialism. Israel as a settler colonial frontier, a Western settler colonial frontier, is giving an opportunity to understand what settler colonialism is and has done. And this is one. The third thing is that the awakening is coming by linking the dots. And look, I mean, we will have a chance to talk once my report is out. But I keep on saying two things as I prepare myself to unveil what I've discovered through the findings of the last 6 months of investigation, that the genocide in Gaza has not stopped because it's lucrative. It's profitable for far too many. It's a business. People have exploited. I mean, there are corporate entities, including from Palestine-friendly states, who have for decades made businesses and made profits out of the economy of the occupation, because Israel has always exploited Palestinian land and resources and Palestinian life. But, I mean, the profits have continued and even increased as the economy of the occupation transformed into an economy of genocide. And again, people need to understand that. Because Palestinians have simply, and I say simply with a lot of pain, and I don't mean disrespectful toward the Palestinians, but they have provided these boundless like training field to test technologies, to test weapons, to test surveillance techniques that now are being used against people everywhere, from the global South to the global North. Look at what's happening in the United States or in Germany. We are spied. I mean, look at the use of drones, of biometrics. These are all things that have been experienced on the Palestinians, first and foremost. So I think that there is this link that unfettered and boundless, unchecked capitalism, which has been like a colonial racial capitalism also for the Palestinians, is detrimental for all of us. So how to respond to this? I do see a movement. I do see a revolution brewing. I call it the watermelon revolution. And it's there. There are young people, workers, anti-Zionist Jews, or Jews who do not recognize themselves as anti-Zionist, but still don't want to have anything to do with Israel's crimes and don't want them to be in their names. So there is this movement. And at the level of countries, I see, for example, the Hague Group, which is a coalition primarily of countries from the global South, and it shouldn't be like that. So I've supported, I've sustained, I've commended these countries. And I call on other states from Asia to Africa, and especially the West, to join the Hague Group, which says, let's start by taking some modicum, some minimal steps to comply with international law. No impunity, no harbor, and no weapons for Israel, which is really basic. But here's where we are, baby steps.
Can you talk about, in this report that's coming out, some of the global corporations that are profiting off of genocide and how they're profiting off of genocide?
I won't be able to tell you much because the report is still embargoed. But I decided to list about 50 corporate entities, from arms manufacturers to big tech companies to construction and to companies providing construction materials or extracting construction materials from the occupied Palestinian territory, to the tourism industry, goods and services, supply chain. You know, there is this, there is, so far, and also these are the two main sectors of the displacement replacement of the Palestinians. And then there is a network of enablers like insurers, pension funds, wealth funds, like pension funds banks, universities, charities. There is it's an ecosystem sustaining this illegality. And you know, the private sector tends to escape scrutiny. They're very smart, and in fact the private sector has historically been either a driver of settler colonialism. Think that during the 1600, for example, think of the companies of the Indies. They were living from the Netherlands, the Dutch ports, to co-reach and colonize West India or Southeast Asia. I mean, why on earth? And this has happened. But also, there are also cases where companies or private entities were not the drivers but the enablers, providing tools, funds for colonial enterprises that then profited them. And this is why big companies and corporate interest have helped shape the law to in a way that allowed them to escape scrutiny. It's not new that companies have profited from genocides, but think of what happened during the Holocaust. The Holocaust industrialist trials helped understand how companies made businesses out of the tragedy of millions of Jewish people. And it's shocking to see that some of the companies were held responsible in the case of the Holocaust industrialist trials, are still involved in the genocide of the Palestinians. There was the South Africa experience after the Truth and Reconciliation Commission concluded its work. Some companies were condemned and to make reparations. So there have been historical moments that have prompted greater regulation for companies. And for example, the UN guiding principles imposing due diligence to companies are an outcome of the South Africa experience. And still, it's not enough. It's definitely not enough because companies continue to operate, you know, in the gray areas of state responsibility. So, if, for example, I put on notice 48 businesses, and the response was, yeah, but it's not our fault, it's Israel. Oh, yeah, it's not up to you to tell us what we should do, it's the state. So, no, I'm sorry, today the occupation is unlawful, Israel has been put on notice, is investigated directly or indirectly in at least three proceedings for genocide, crimes against humanity and war crimes, and you cannot continue business as usual. And if you do, you will have to face justice. So this is probably the storm that I will help to mount against them, is to make sure that civil society and lawyers in every country where these businesses are registered are active. And also that consumers know that they can vote, that they can bail out. They can make sure, for example, there are tourism companies who advise settlement properties. You should seal, or for example, real estate agents who sell nice English-speaking neighborhood in the heart of Judea and Samaria. Ah, yes. So this is normalization of the occupation by a click. And you are going to be punished, maybe not in court, but surely you will lose a lot of clients when they will know what you do.